most of the living room conversations that we've done, there's been one billionaire in the room. So they're bringing a lot of money. And of course, we have to say it's not just resources of money, but it's also vast networks, heart, lived experience that makes their point of view like just different and fundamentally important to have in the conversation right now. And for the most part, these are folks who have not been asked, invited to sit at any of the philanthropic tables that currently exist in our country right now.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was glad to have the chance to talk with Ashindi Maxton and Holly Lee of Donors of Color Network. They're both highly qualified and knowledgeable in the world of philanthropy and have the experience and passion to put together such an enterprise. Holly and Ashindi tell a compelling story about their process, and it does seem like their idea is useful and has real potential. So after a quick word with our sponsor, my interview with Ashindi Maxton and Holly Lee of the Donors of Color Network.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
What I'd like to have each of you do in turn is just introduce yourself and give me a quick biography.
So my name is Holly. Hi, Nathaniel. I am in Brooklyn, New York City, a borough that I love. I was born in Korea and I grew up in Kansas City. My family immigrated when I was an infant, and I got the benefit of a great public education in Kansas City, went to Princeton for college, went to social work school and studied Buddhism in Thailand after college, and I've been working in nonprofits and philanthropy for my whole adult career, doing a lot of work, especially in growing grassroots philanthropy via giving circles. And it is my great pleasure and honor to get to work with Ashindi Maxton as co-director of the Donors of Color Network now, which is the first national project and endeavor to network, engage, organize high net worth people of color around their giving and their philanthropy.
I noticed in your online biography, Holly, that you worked on Asian women giving circles.
Yep, that's my side gig in a way. I'm the founder of the Asian Women Giving Circle, which is an all-volunteer group of awesome, badass Asian American women. We fund arts and culture in New York City as a tool for social change, progressive social change in communities. We've moved over $1 million into local communities in New York, funding Asian American women who use the tools of arts and culture to bring about equitable social change in their community. So we funded documentary films and spoken word and dance and poetry and writing, all sorts of cool stuff done by artists, activists in the Asian American community. And there's kind of this fun, we can talk about this on another podcast, maybe, Nathaniel. There's a burgeoning movement of giving circles nationally, which is a cool thing, especially now post-Trump. Citizen activists getting engaged in making their communities better. There's political giving circles, there's charitable giving circles, there's sister giving circles, gay men giving circles all over the place, like little random particles of awesomeness spinning in communities all over our country. So I've been part of a national effort to kind of build something that undergirds those social entrepreneurs, I guess.
And I've actually am part of one here in DC that's focused on poverty.
You are. I would love to hear about that. What do you call yourselves?
It's a nonprofit called Lever Fund that really operates more or less as a giving circle.
Awesome. We can talk offline about this too if you're interested in plugging into this national.
Yeah, I'm sure I should learn from you.
Yeah.
Holly, what's Faces of Giving?
So Faces of Giving is a nonprofit that I started 3 years ago with a friend who is now peeled off to do her own thing. And we started it as a vehicle to democratize the field and practice of philanthropy, thinking that we could create a home for giving circles. Because as you know, since you're part of one, oftentimes in the philanthropic world, giving circles are kind of like the stepchild, you know, the stepchild of the stepchild. People don't think we're real donors. They want major donors. They don't like groups of grassroots donors because they think we're kind of a pain in the neck. So we created this nonprofit to help build philanthropy in communities of color. Within like a minute of forming the C3, we met Urvashi and Ashindi and started working on this Donors of Color project, which at that time was a research project. And Ashindi and I will get into the different streams of research that we've done that form the foundation of this network that we're now building. So Faces of Giving has now become really the C3 holder for the Donors of Color network. And we might change the name of Faces of Giving. We're going to figure it out. But it's basically got one project that it's doing right now, which is the Donors of Color Network.
And Holly, is this how you make a living?
Yeah, I'm full-time on this Donors of Color project with Ashindi. She is now full-time on this project. We're paying ourselves a decent wage, maybe not quite as much as we were making before, but can't complain because, you know, for me, I get to do something that I totally love and believe in, and its values aligned with my values. So I consider myself super lucky.
Ashindi, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a biography?
So I'm Ashindi. I am very happy to be the co-director of the Donors of Color Project, which launched officially in February as a network. Before that, what I've been doing for about the last 12 years is strategy for high net worth donors and donor networks. I helped create different collaborative projects for groups of donors that include Reflective Democracy, the Emergent Fund, New Media Ventures, a bunch of things that are collaborations between a number of donors who are kind of coming together around a common strategy and pulling the biggest lever that they can find. My job has generally been to find that lever and organize the resources around it. And before this, I was actually did some policy work, but really background is in education. So I was a fourth and fifth grade Spanish bilingual teacher, which turns out to be actually surprisingly relevant for working with donors. It's very helpful to have the skill set of, you know, taking complicated material and breaking it down and communicating it so that other people own it. And I was an elementary school principal of an arts charter school here in Washington, D.C. And I have an odd sort of errant background in science. Those are the pieces that are coming together in what I do now.
You're a Vassar grad and a MPP at Berkeley, right?
That's right. Yeah. And actually two of the three founders of this project are Vassar grads. So Urvashi Bad, who is our, you know, sort of conceived of and was the original founder of this project, is also a Vassar girl.
Ashindi, you went to the NAACP for a few years?
That's right. I was the policy director at the NAACP, which was kind of the gateway into what I do now. The pivot being that at the NAACP, my job was to kind of bring together all of the different pieces of the work that was happening there into a coherent policy. So I worked across political engagement, economic affairs, international affairs, criminal justice, and helped to kind of build the strategies around those pieces and, you know, sort of how they added up to more than the sum of their parts. I ended up at the Democracy Alliance when I left the NAACP, which is when the president who hired me left. I had developed this kind of expertise in voting rights. They happen to need a strategy in voting rights, just as I had acquired this fairly new piece of knowledge and just as voting rights turned out to be a really important piece of work. So I went to the Democracy Alliance to do that. It was 2007, and it turned out that, you know, voter suppression was suddenly an issue everyone was ready to talk about because we ended up with the first Black man seriously running for president, you know, as the actual Democratic nominee. So a lot of money poured into this piece of work around voter access and, you know, ending voter suppression. And having been the one who created the strategy and brought the donors together, that was the launching pad into doing strategy for high net worth donors for and with.
And Democracy Alliance is a pretty important group of donors in the progressive space. I interviewed Gara LaMarche earlier on the podcast about it, but how was your time there?
How much time you got?
It was a place where I learned a lot about the power of high net worth donors. I would connect it to the Donors of Color work in the sense of having gained the special skill set of what it looks like to organize the money that's aggregating at the top of the economy. And it doesn't look like, you know, sort of where I think the real revolution is, which is in like middle and low income donors. And aggregating big numbers of people, which is a whole different skill set. But at the Democracy Alliance, I learned a lot about what it looks like to find the energy of a big set of donors. And I learned that it's a very particular skill set, very specialized, to take this money that's at the top of the economy and organize it. The other thing that I learned was that there really is a lot of access and power that only happens with donors at that level. So seeing that, you know, when those donors spoke, they could really move things. You know, for better or worse. And it was a real eye-opening thing to see that even our most progressive donors have pretty significant blind spots when it comes to race. And it's a big part of kind of what set the stage both for, you know, Irvishi and I, as two of the earliest folks in this work, is that Irvishi and I both saw up close like what was happening at the Democracy Alliance, not because anyone, you know, certainly Gera wasn't not making an effort to bring in people of color, but that it just wasn't a space that was comfortable for high net worth donors of color, which meant that if those voices are missing in the room, and yet this is the only very powerful group of progressive donors engaging in a political way, for example, something was missing in a way that really mattered and had consequences.
Sounds like donors of color were few and far between at that alliance.
They're few and far between everywhere. We did some research. So I interviewed, I'm going to say maybe somewhere between 14 and 20 different donor networks or sort of aggregations of people who, you know, had organized high net worth donors in some way. And one of the things we learned that's 100% consistent is whoever founded the network sets the DNA for that network. And however much work they do later, like their DNA is set. So all of the existing donor networks were created primarily by white donors, and that is what's reflected later. So it was part of the question we were asking is like, well, where are these donors? Is it that there aren't any donors of color who could be in these donor networks, which was kind of the working theory that it was like, you know, structural racism or something that was keeping these rooms so predominantly white, you know, or was it that these donors weren't interested in the things that, you know, for example, the Democracy Alliance was doing, which is another theory that I heard, you know, it's like, oh, they're just not inherently as into this work as we are. The conclusion we came to in our research, which we should describe for you, is that nobody had created a home for these donors. And once we created the home, it turned out like we could interview and recruit endlessly from the network of high net worth people of color that we have tapped into. But if you don't start with and from the needs of that group of people, like you're not drawing them in.
Got it. I'm glad you guys are working on that. You also spent a lot of time at the SEIU, if I read it correctly, doing partnerships.
I did political partnerships at the SEIU. So this was all of the sort of community-facing partnerships that the political team coordinated. And we were trying to really follow through on a vision that came from Mary Kay Henry, that part of what it was going to take to save unions and to really support labor in this new political environment that we're in that is so anti-labor is to work much more closely from and with the needs of communities. And so my job there involved things like partnership with the National Association of Community Health Centers, you know, which at the time was serving 30 million people, is probably closer to 50 or 60 million now, getting people registered to vote at their doctor's office, because this was the part of the electorate that was being served by community health centers and also least likely to be registered, most likely to kind of be a game-changing group if we engage them well. So, you know, the first time I went to the National Association of Community Health Centers conference, they were very tentative and, you know, sort of neutral and guarded about the idea of doing voter registration in those centers. And once we started piloting it with money from the SEIU political team, it became actually very powerful, like what we saw was possible there. And then we did an Asian American voting project, which was partnering with Asian American voting groups and our locals in five different states, just to look at like, what did it look like to do Asian American turnout? And we did all kinds of like frontier building work, like stuff that the Obama campaign told us was too hard and they hadn't managed it. But these local Asian groups with just a bit of resource from the SEIU political team were able to do like language identification programs that no one had ever done, quadrupling the Asian vote in Las Vegas that year, like having a slate of candidates that were supported with a narrative about like how they could not do it without the Asian vote. But just really powerful work. So it was really teaching us something about the power of labor to partner with communities and make a huge difference if you invest directly in that work coming from them and that leadership. And I would say that's, again, like a really fundamental piece of what shaped our approach at the Donors of Color Network, which was the understanding that actually like following the lead of those communities led us to much better outcomes than telling them what to do and funding just only our own plan, but that the work was way more powerful when we funded from the interests and needs of the people that we were trying to support.
It sounds like a really useful lesson and a pretty interesting place to be working for a while.
Yeah, it really was. And I mean, labor dwarfs almost everything else, or it did. There's a reason the right went after it, right? Compared to working at the Democracy Alliance or compared to working with the Ford Foundation, which I did at some point as a consultant, labor dwarfs what almost anyone else is capable of. And I'm like, oh, the right was very smart to come after it because like in its strength, it has more ability than I think almost anything else on the table to be transformative and to be transformative for like the most needy communities. Again, when we invest in the right set of leaders.
What did you like and not like about working there?
At SEIU? Mm-hmm. I mean, what I loved about it really was the power. Like it was, I mean, it was just like the ability to give power to working class people, like what it could do for working class people. I loved that. I loved Mary Kay's interest in innovating around that question of how to build power in collaboration with communities. What was hard is it's a big institution, you know, with all of the internal politics and challenges of any big institution. It's harder. It's like you're operating very, very heavy machinery and, you know, it doesn't spin on a dime. It requires a lot of kind of historical knowledge and expertise to like drive that heavy machinery. And, you know, it takes a while to learn. So that was challenging.
What is Free Speech TV?
Free Speech TV is the only progressive television network left standing. You know, we had a few. There was Al Gore's venture, which I think was called Fusion. And Free Speech TV, I think, is now in like 50 million homes. It's had a pretty big growth spurt, a lot of increase in viewer support, a lot more market access. But it is a place where, you know, like Amy Goodman, like Free Speech TV was the first person to put Amy Goodman on television. And Tom Hartman. And we have disproportionate reach into rural communities. There aren't that many people like creating political consciousness, especially in rural areas. So it had a special role in kind of putting progressive voices onto TV. So I left there a year and a half ago, but I did chair that board during a really interesting moment of transition. And with the idea that like, if you're trying to create progressive power, like TV really matters and like messaging people who don't otherwise hear from us also really matters.
Well, I can see that you're both qualified to start a Donors of Color network. Can you tell me about the founding story there?
It did start in the halls of the Democracy Alliance. You know, I was not there at this particular conference, but it was Irva Shuvad and a few other people of color who were really noticing that all of the people presenting were people of color. They had the question, you know, that I was mentioning earlier of like kind of where are the donors of color? Do they exist? The Marguerite Casey Foundation decided to put a small grant behind doing research on this question. And Irva, she hired me to help her with the research. We wrote the Apparitional Donor Report, which you might have come across, you know, that turned out to be relatively exhaustive about anything that had been written about donors of color up until 2016. And the big surprise in doing that research, you know, in this 160-page report was, oh, wow, like no one has written about high net worth donors of color. Like what we put together was very pointillistic data about like research about high net worth donors, none of which accounted for race, like all of which seemed to assume that all high net worth donors were the same and would have the same interests and priorities. And then research about like very specific groups like Chinese American giving in Silicon Valley or Black donors in New England. And we kind of gleaned as much as we could from this pointillistic research, but realized like there were real limitations. So, you know, although we had put together something quite comprehensive as of 2016, there were just a ton of outstanding questions, especially if what you wanted to do was organize and engage these donors, you needed another level of research. And so Holly came in with her partner Tahina at the time and did 112 interviews of these donors. And that to me is by far the richest source of information that we have about these donors. Like when I read these interviews, I just think there's absolutely nothing like them. And, you know, we really created the network based on a lot of what we learned from those interviews. Simultaneously, I did a piece of research that was on interviewing, you know, a bunch of donor networks, the case statement that we mentioned. Is that it for the research so far, Holly?
Yes. Three streams.
Yes. And then you might want to talk about what we learned in those interviews that was part of also what led us to feeling like somebody had to build the home for donors of color as opposed to colorizing the existing donor networks.
which is kind of what we thought we would do, right? Like when we started this project, we kind of assumed that there would be a network that we could just plug these donors that we were finding into, or that they could just join the networks that already exist. You know, for the progressive political ones, they could just go to the DA, or people interested in women and girls and gender could go to Women Donors Network. For those interested in political stuff, they could go to Solidaire. So just to go back a step, and so that you see all the strands, there were three strands of research that undergird the kind of the why of why we're forming this donor network now. So as Shani mentioned, the apparitional donor, which is a landscape analysis, that was part one of the research. Part two of the research was doing interviews, which I'll talk about. And then part three was kind of doing a deep dive into the donor networks that already exist and asking questions about how they've tried to integrate their networks to people who have different lived experiences and backgrounds than those of the founders. Part two was research. So if you look at like qualitative studies and research in the philanthropic space, usually people stop at 20 or 30 interviews. And that just seems so paltry given the dearth of data out there and that really this doesn't exist. This data doesn't exist. So we picked 100, which is kind of random. And it's also not representative of anything other than these are people that we could get to. And we ended up finding and interviewing 112 individual high net worth donors of color in 10 cities across the country. And I got to interview all of them except for maybe five. The criteria of high net worth for our study, our research, and it's, you know, we pulled philanthropic banking and census data to come up with a working definition of high net worth, which is the capacity to give away $50,000 per year or more, which roughly translates to liquid net investable assets of $1 million. For ultra high net worth, we define that as the capacity to give away $1 million per year or more, which roughly translates to liquid net investable assets of $30 million. Irvashi and I are writing up the report right now, but I can share some top level kind of themes that have come out of these conversations. We spent like 90 minutes or more, in some cases like there was this one like super intense banker in New York who's Korean American. I'm Korean. And it, just from his demeanor, we thought this was going to be like a 45-minute one and done conversation because he was in such a hurry. We went back twice. We spent 4 hours with this guy. You know, he was just like a floodgate of stories and information and inspiration and ideas. So you just kind of never can tell. But in general, the conversations were in person, 90-minute long conversations around family and values and tell us your story. Tell us who you admire, like who led the way for you. What values do you want to see in the world and how does your philanthropy help you get there? Those kinds of things. And at the end of the 90 minutes, we start asking questions about where the person or couple is giving their money away and what guides them. And do they do any political giving, giving to churches, any giving in support of family and friends, any money being sent back home if there's a recent immigration story in that person's family or story. And kind of importantly there, which is something that's different about our research, is that we ask about types of giving that aren't C3 charitable giving, because 80% of the people that we interviewed are wealth earners and wealth creators themselves, so that they grew up poor, working class, or middle class in many cases. So they're the first of their family to break into another socioeconomic class. A significant number of them are giving a significant number of dollars in support of family and friends who are still living in middle income, low income, and poor situations. So we ask about that. A lot of the folks we interviewed send money back home if they're recently immigrated. We ask about that. You know, none of this is like tax deductible charitable contributions, but they're an important part of how someone thinks of their generosity and their giving. We ask about church giving and political giving for the same reasons. And then, of course, we asked about like, you know, C3 charitable giving as well. I guess a few themes to share from the interviews. Every single person we interviewed, no matter the color of their skin, has personally experienced racism, discrimination, or bias based on their color of their skin, their country of origin, their accent, their religion, something. You know, it's not like a huge leap to assume or to figure that that life experience, that lived experience, will inform how they think about giving their money away, especially if you remember that 80% of the folks that we've
interviewed so far are wealth earners and wealth creators themselves. A really large percentage of them talk about systemic barriers to accumulating and creating wealth in their families. And they might not call it the racial wealth gap when they're telling their story, but they talk about mom and dad not being able to get married in this state because of anti-miscegenation laws, which made that family have to uproot and move and leave behind years of building whatever they were building in that state to another state. They talk about their families being redlined, so not getting to buy a home in this part of San Jose and having to go to that part of San Jose because their family was Black. They talk about their family's farms being stolen from them because of Japanese internment, or a piece of land being taken from them at fractions of its cost because great-grandma happened to be Black. You know, so there's lots and lots of stories in people's immediate families that tell the story of why there's a racial wealth gap in America. Significant amounts of dollars going in support of family and friends. And Ashindi's heard this a million times, but we interviewed a couple in Brooklyn who give away about $75,000 per year charitably. But in that same year that we asked them about, they gave $500,000 in support of aunties and uncles and cousins and sisters and brothers and nieces and nephews who were in need of whatever the need was. So that's a pretty big factor in the families that who we interviewed. About half of our sample has a recent immigration history, and about half are born in the U.S., often people who were descended from enslaved people, African-American people, also a handful of Native American people in our sample. The folks that we interviewed are kind of ridiculously accomplished. There are many, many PhD, multiple graduate degrees, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, MIT show up kind of alarmingly a lot in the backgrounds of the folks we interviewed. We have a double Rhodes Scholar couple that we got to interview. And these folks in general are really well networked, whether it's through a fraternal organization or alumni network or like a Asian American bankers network, professional networks, social networks, collegiate, family. Incredibly well networked and connected, but yet at the same time, this like incredible sense of loneliness, you know, this sense of being, I'm the only one like me in this room, in the many rooms that I inhabit. I'm the only wealthy person in my extended family. I'm the only Asian woman in this room. I'm the only Black man in this kind of room, or there's three of us out of 300, or we started out as a class of 100, and by the 10 years later, I'm the only one left. You know, there's so many stories of being the only one, of kind of being a unicorn. And so there's this great hunger to be in rooms where they're with other people like them. I mean, Ashindi and I were in two different rooms, one in Seattle and one in California, over the course of a few months, where upon entering, two grown men cried. You know, they just, it was like they didn't even realize how powerful it was to be in a room of wealthy POC talking about their giving and their families and their stories, that they just burst into tears. It's actually really moving. We can tell you more about this in a few minutes, but you know, we just convened for the first time. We had an inaugural retreat of the Donors of Color Network at the very end of February and early March, and there were 73 people in those rooms over 4 days. And out of 73 people, all of whom are incredibly powerful in their own ways, whether they bring resources or their foundation VPs or movement organizers or political geniuses, incredibly powerful people, including 48 individual high net worth donors of color, there were four white people out of that room of 73. And no one had ever been in a room like that, you know, and it just fundamentally changed everything. People were connecting. They said things like, this is cathartic. I've never seen or been in a room like this. I feel like I can take my armor off. I don't have to feel so defended. I can be my real self. It was very powerful. That's really the kind of heart and feeling reason why this network needs to exist. And then there's political reasons why this network needs to exist. And, you know, as Ashindi mentioned before, with the great sort of bifurcation of wealth and wealth inequality in our country right now, there's just so many more people who are wealthy at the top of the economic chain. And that's true in POC communities as it is true in white families, white communities. So that's the reason why we're forming this network for socioeconomic reasons. And then I guess just the base fundamental reason is to create a powerful, nourishing, strategic home for donors of color And it's a home that really just has never existed before.
It sounds like an amazing project. And just starting with the interviews, as someone who obviously likes to interview and talk to people myself, to get to know people like that and have a reason to put them together, it just sounds like a really fulfilling project.
It's been a blast. Ashidi was saying that her fifth grade teaching and principal experience, like, kind of comes in handy sometimes. And for me, like, having been a social worker, a clinical social worker, and a therapist at various points in my life, that this is coming in really handy, you know. And so the person-to-person contact, and it's, for me, I got to do these interviews over a course of a little over two years. And I was so excited for, you know, so-and-so in Seattle to meet so-and-so in from DC, and Mr. and Mrs. blah blah from here to meet, you know. I was so excited because I knew they were just going to love each other, and to get to see that happen in New Mexico when we had this retreat was just a blast. It was really fun. And Ashidi often says, like, this is like a group of donors that she's this is unlike any group of donors that she's ever worked with, and which is true.
My wife is Asian American, and she went in like 97, 98 to an Asian women's leadership conference. And so that was Indians and other Asians and all sorts of people. And she made friends there that she has and we have to today, I think, just because of the different kind of environment was for her. I think having people like you around, it's a different thing.
Totally.
Yeah. And you're talking about shared identity, like the power of shared identity. There's a lot there. I mean, one thing that's really interesting about our network is that it's cross-racial. Somebody asked us really early on in the project, like, what is there in your research that implies that you can create a cross-racial donor network? And we had to say, like, nothing. You know, like, there's nothing in the research that implies that's possible.
Well, the fact that you're both in it, right? I mean, you and your other co-founders. I want to ask about the intersection between progressive politics and this. So given that it came out of Democracy Alliance halls, as you say, and your own background, but not all donors of color are progressive. How have you made that intersection of importance inside the network? And what are your plans for directing political giving?
One is that we haven't. We don't use the word progressive. I don't think we do. I might have used it earlier in reference to my other work. But what we have decided on is that this is a network that is committed to systemic change that creates racial equity. And so you can identify as progressive or not and still believe in leveling the playing field. So we thought very carefully about how to language that, right? And racial equity is a term that the donors themselves told us, like, this is what unites us, and this is like language that they're comfortable with. Progressive, just for me, honestly, Nathaniel, is a word that I feel like I consistently encounter in whites-only spaces or predominantly white spaces. And so it's a word that, like, I personally actually have come to have a little bit of aversion to, ironically, despite the fact that I've, you know, sort of been working around progressive politics for a long time. So I think it was easy for me to avoid, you know, using that term.
You don't hear a lot of calls for racial equity coming out of the Trump administration.
Well, yes, that's certainly true. But I also don't think we've been very effective. Like, if you look at, like, the Democratic Party, I think it's ineffective in any number of ways on racial equity. And it's really, I mean, think about how disturbing it is that race is the defining factor of what is happening, like, at the polarization of America, at some of the worst policies coming out of this White House. And yet the Democratic Party is still utterly ineffective at talking about race and engaging us around, you know, our highest ideals that relate to race. So I think there's just a lot of room for people who are able to, you know, grapple with racial equity, put it at the forefront, center the experience that this group of donors is bringing as their lived experience that's not coming from the sort of traditional left. You're right that, you know, certainly not all donors of color are progressive, and they're not all interested in racial equity or, you know, issues related to race at all. So we're really comfortable with the fact that this is not going to be a home for all donors of color. You know, we're trying to create a set of shared values, because without that, we don't stand for anything. Those shared values are what are going to make this community powerful, but we wanted to define them, like, clearly enough that people who don't see this as what they want to commit to, like, feel totally comfortable going on and doing something else. The research was values neutral. So, you know, those interviews, we interviewed everyone who we had access to within the time that we had to interview people. The research that Irvashi Vad and I did was also, you know, values agnostic. But the case studies that we did of donor networks, one of the big lessons from that was
anyone who tried to bring people together around just shared identity without any shared values did not do effective work. And we saw case after case of that. So we knew that we needed to have something that would tie this community together, and it was racial equity and systemic change.
Given that that's sort of your mission, racial equity, and I don't know whether that means programs to move the country in that direction or what are you looking at? Where are you hoping that money from this network will go, or where has it started to go?
That's a great question, because there are donor networks that exist, including networks of very wealthy, powerful people that do not move money together. And me being, I'm kind of new to the high net worth donor organizing space, and that was really surprising to me. And I think it's something that our donors, and Ashindi and I, are really in agreement on, which is that why wouldn't we move money together? You know, like when we think about the ways in which a group of donors can be powerful together, why wouldn't moving money together be one of those things that we can do, right, to be powerful? In a similar way, this is a little bit in response to your last question, there is some interest among a subset of our donors to be powerful in the political arena. Why wouldn't we consider that, especially given the moment that our country is in right now, socially and politically? And then another arena, like the sort of private investing, impact investing, private sector world, there's a group of donors, again, a subset, not the whole group that we're convening, but a subset of our donors are really interested in being powerful in the impact investing private sector world. Why wouldn't we consider that, right? Like if we wanted to think about how we can be powerful as a group. So in terms of work, we're just starting. We launched this network at our inaugural retreat in New Mexico like 6 weeks ago. Out of that gathering, our donors formed 8 working groups. And 2 of them, I would say, Ashindi, right, are going to look into doing a pooled fund of some sort, possibly around climate and how climate change is affecting POC communities first and worst. Like, how can we be a player and a funder and active in that space? Another area of interest I think our donors are interested in is culture as a force and a strategy for change, equitable social change. I think those are the 2 that might lead to pooled fundings. That would be my guess right now. And then there's also the possibility that some of our donors might be interested in joining other pooled funds that exist out there, or we might go together to some other donor networks that, say, are active in the political space, like Way to Win, or donor networks who care about women and girls and gender, like Women Donors Network. I could see a subset of our donors with us going together to their gatherings, conferences, and their pooled funds.
So you have 73 people who went to your retreat. Are those basically a subset of the people you interviewed? How does someone join that group if they want to, or how are you pulling them in?
We're figuring that out. Many of the donors who came, so 48 donors came, and many of them had been interviewed by us, or they'd come to a living room conversation, or at the very least they had a phone call. So these are like invitation only, fairly curated group at this point. And then the other folks who came were like the foundations that have funded us from the beginning, they each sent a person or 2. And then we invited some movement leaders who came to inspire and be in community with our donors.
So there's a letter of engagement for these donors. The biggest kind of widest point of the funnel are these big public events that we've done to share the research. So Holly and I will go and, you know, speak to a room full of people. These events almost always sell out. Like 360 people came in Dallas last fall, and they're open to everyone. In any one of those rooms, there is some percentage of high net worth donors of color. And every event is hosted by someone. So like the Dallas Women's Foundation, or the Women Donors Network, the Ford Foundation, Open Society, the Democracy Alliance sponsored one for us. And so then we often get connections through people outing themselves in the room as potential members, or connections by the host. And then we do these living room convenings that are all donors only. So picture, instead of kind of like a presentation to a packed room, we're having 15 to 20 people in someone's living room. Those donor-only events tend to be extremely powerful because, as Holly said, people often have very emotional reactions to being in those spaces and to like being like, wow, everyone in this room is like in a similar situation to me, and they've usually not experienced that. A high percentage of those people convert. And then Holly's interviews are also, they're one-on-ones. Like, you know, in addition to like a data gathering tool, Holly has this social work background. So like people feel warmed and, you know, seen and heard by her.
So when she calls them to come to an event, they come. And if you think about the fact that we interviewed 112 people, and then we had a 4-day expensive gathering in a place that wasn't easy to get to, and we had 50 of them, which was pretty much our goal, show up. It says a lot about the conversion rate of, like, you know, people who just are exposed to people who really want to make a pretty big commitment of showing up to, you know, the middle of the desert for 4 days.
Yeah, we did not make it easy for them.
We didn't make it easy on purpose. You know, like, we wanted for this initial convening, we wanted kind of our most hardcore values aligned people, the people who were truly potential members. Like, we realized that we were creating this DNA in that gathering. And so we were really thoughtful about who we recruited, you know, who did we call multiple times and say, like, we really need you in this room. We were very thoughtful about seeing these people as kind of the foremothers and forefathers of this network we're creating. And I wanted to go back and say, too, about what we're funding, which is the one piece Holly missed, is that, like, we are co-creating this with the donors, which is why we don't have an answer yet. The research told us this as well. Like, we could tell them this is what we're doing and just see who, you know, who's drawn to that. But the research told us, like, that these donor networks must be co-created by staff. They must have staff. And then they have to have donors centered in what the strategy is. So the moment you're catching us in is, like, between the launch, which was just 2 months ago, and then the co-creation with the donors. Like, we're in that process, and the working groups are kind of how we're going to get to that answer of where their energy is and how they want to move forward.
That's really cool. I wonder, what is the universe in this country of potential donors of color network members? I bet it's huge, because if you go into something like Wealth Engine, one of these things that purport to track the wealth of different people for nonprofits.
Yeah. Well, you're pointing to a piece of data that is so far
elusive.
It is elusive. That's a good word. It's not missing. I was not able to pull it out of the census except in a very rough form. We contracted with Target Smart, who, you know, normally does political modeling, to model for us, you know, well, how many people of color in this country have over $1 million in liquid net investable assets, right? Which is basically our target demographic. The modeled numbers tell us it's somewhere between, like, 1.5 and 2 million of Black and Brown millionaires and billionaires.
Which makes 48 not a giant amount.
That's right. That's absolutely exactly right.
You've got a lot of running room.
We really do. And then Holly could interview people for months. Like, we could interview people for as long as we had time. Because now that the networks are open to us, they're open. But look, like any other donor network, ask them for their list of people of color who they're ready to recruit. It's going to be very short. They could probably, like, number them on their fingers, because it's really about what network did you tap into and, like, what kind of trust were you able to build within that network? Because the numbers are there.
Donor networks that we've looked at as, like, peer networks, they usually top out at 300 people. We only need to organize a tiny subset of that 2 million high net worth POC households that are, you know, POC-led households.
Either that or just Oprah.
No, well, yeah, that's a good point.
We have a whole billionaire approach.
They need their own strategy, Nathaniel.
Yes, I'll share with you my controversial thoughts about billionaires, because I know enough of them to actually have generalizations to make, which is that, like, you know, the billionaires, like, have their own agendas, right? So Oprah, like, organize her around her own agenda. We don't need her in a network. Because, like, billionaires don't have to work inside of partnerships. So we were pretty intentional with this group of, like, not going after celebrities, because we didn't want anyone to be the center or defining person in this network or to be calling the shots.
Do you have sort of a top amount that, like, wealth, you,
nobody
above
over
which
this
you,
amount?
No, thanks.
No, yeah. No, we don't. We haven't, and I don't think we will. It's more just, like, who are we going after? Because if you want a billionaire, you have to, like, generally recruit them very intentionally and, again, in accordance with their interest. But the only interest, in my experience, that somebody that wealthy has in being in a donor network is to leverage the other people, because for the most part, anything that they want to do, they can do already. So the interest is less in being, like, a equal member of a organization. Again, these are generalizations, but I have found them to be largely true.
And it speaks to one of our goals and values is to co-create this network with donors of color, right? So it was smart not to have a celebrity in the room at our inaugural retreat in New Mexico, because otherwise it would have been like Oprah's network, and this would have become Oprah's network, or this would have become Barack's
network,
Robert
Thompson,
or whatever,
network,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not that we would have gotten all of these people in the room anyways, but we tried not to. And so the result is that the people in the room, who are many of them, who are literally the millionaire next door, whose names you do not know, but who've just worked really hard, socked it away, and now they have money to give. Now it's going to be their network, you know, so it goes towards this co-creation thing as well. And then just to add on one more thing about like interviewing forever, when we speak, a lot of times it's like, you know, development directors and nonprofit people and boards, you know, everyone's dying to have high net worth donors of color on their boards and counted in their donor roles. But what we've been doing has been, you know, slow, methodical, this ladder of engagement. It's like really using an organizer's mindset to build this community from the ground up and co-creating this community with donors, right? So, and as Ashini said, like, we could keep interviewing forever. Like, people are calling us now to be interviewed and to add to the research. I could go back to Dallas probably 10 times and just keep interviewing people, because once you sort of start building and then they refer people to you and they learn that Ashini and I are not monsters and not rapacious and we want to do this thing together for the good of the world, you know.
And based on their interests. Because one of the biggest things that we have seen is that where people have been successful bringing donors of color together often does have to do with a particular agenda, you know, the Smithsonian Museum of Black History or the Obama campaign, or those groups don't stay together. Like, once the thing is done, you know, they're done. And then for the smaller organizations, like the development directors and the boards and all of the people who kind of want our donors, they have an agenda they want to plug them into. And it's very different than, you know, what we've done, which is say, like, what do you need? And how can we help you co-create that? And it's the one thing we have found, like, no existing donor network, to our knowledge, has done, which is, you know, less to say, like, here's our agenda, or here's our organization, we would love to have you, but to say, like, what is helpful to you in this world? And how do we build it together?
You've mentioned a couple times that there's other co-founders. Can you say a word about who they are?
Yes. there are four of us. So Holly and I, Irvashi Vad, who was the original sort of mother of the project, who raised the initial money and co-wrote The Apparitional Donor and is still involved as a very important strategic advisor for us. And Tuhina O'Connor was also involved at the very earliest stages as a partner.
Is there a question that I neglected to ask that I should have that you'd like to answer?
You didn't ask what kind of resources these people are bringing.
What kind of resources are these people bringing?
Almost 30% of our interview sample brings net assets of $30 million or more, which was a happy surprise for us because, you know, we just didn't know what we were going to find going in, which is awesome. Most of the living room conversations that we've done, there's been one billionaire in the room. So they're bringing a lot of money. And of course, we have to say it's not just resources of money, but it's also vast networks, heart, lived experience that makes their point of view like just different and fundamentally important to have in the conversation right now. And for the most part, these are folks who have not been asked, invited to sit at any of the philanthropic tables that currently exist in our country right now. And this is a moment in time where their resources, hearts, networks, lived experiences are more important than ever to be at those tables.
I feel honored to talk to you guys today. Is there anything else you want to say, either of you?
I think I'm most excited about the potential of this network to use the lived experience they have and then the resources and privilege that they are really conscious of to change the playing field, like to change the game. I think this group of people could be like truly game changers at a moment that we most need them and need to center their lived experience. So we're just excited. Like the other reason this this network exists is because like there's a desperate historical need to not just level the playing field, but to like envision a whole new reality and then resource it, right? Like make it, birth it, bring it into being. And I think this group of donors has an incredibly important and historic role to play in making that happen.
This is a really optimistic project. It's fundamentally an optimistic and building project. And for us to get to work on this right now and be in community with these folks is a big honor and privilege and joyful.
It makes me happier to know it's going on. And and I hope that you make it a success and something that really starts to change the country, because we can sure use the help.
Thanks so much for having us, Nathaniel.
Thank you, Nathaniel.
So that was the Shindy and Holly of Donors of Color Network. They're at donorsofcolor.org. I really learned a lot from my conversation with them about how to carefully put together a new community. I look forward to hearing more about their group making change going forward. And while the purpose of Donors of Color isn't centrally political, I'm hopeful that they make a positive change in our country, both by pursuing racial equity and with some more overt progressive political work as well. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.